Welcome to Politics Up Close on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Republican Mark Crockett is trying to put the focus on Salt Lake County's debt and spending as he runs for county mayor. The GOP nominee has a plan to restructure county government and make it more efficient, but his opponent and the incumbent mayor have accused him of making the county's debt levels look much higher than they actually are. He'll join us to discuss the specifics of his plan as Election Day draws closer. And on the week of the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, journalist Kurt Eichenwald has reignited the debate over how much the Bush administration knew about a looming attack by al-Qaeda leading up to the tragedy. He'll join us to talk about his controversial piece and his new book on the days after 9/11. Politics Up Close is coming up right after the news here on NPR Utah, KCPW. Good morning and welcome to Politics Up Close here on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. A little over 7 weeks remain for the two candidates competing in perhaps the most competitive race in Utah, the Salt Lake County Mayor's Contest, to make their case to voters before they go to the polls. While Democrat Ben McAdams has focused on his ability to compromise and reach out to the GOP, Republican Mark Crockett has focused in on Salt Lake County's debt and expensive projects such as a proposed Broadway-style theater downtown or plans to build a convention center hotel. The former county councilman joins me now in the studio for an update on his campaign. And, Mark, it's good to have you back.
Jeff, it's great to be here again.
Mark Crockett and Ben McAdams will both appear at a Meet the County Mayor Candidates Night that's coming up on September 26th at 6 p.m. at the County Government Center and will be broadcast live here on KCPW. For more information on that, go to our website at kcpw.org. Well, Mark, in general, tell us what you've been up to these past couple days and weeks on the campaign trail, and how are you getting your message out?
Well, I think people are finally interested in campaigns. it was nice for a lot of people to have a summer spending time with family and vacations and then getting kids back to school. At this point, we've been out talking with a lot of people around the valley, trying to make sure we're in every part of the whole valley. And, of course, occasionally raising some money and getting our messages ready. We will be actually going out live with most of our messages and our advertising and things like that here in a couple weeks.
So what are the subjects that come up primarily, Mark, when you talk to voters about county government specifically?
The first question, of course, is, so what does the county do?
Yep.
A lot of people don't know. They don't know that it's $820 million budget, 3,600 employees, that it's a big executive job to be mayor. This is not just a legislative meet and greet. This is a real job that takes a lot of experience to do, and that's what most of the people we're talking with seem to focus on.
Are people as concerned about the county's debt as you are in this campaign, kind of making it really the number one issue?
I don't know that I'm trying to make it the number one issue. What I am trying to make the issue is we have a big, complicated organization, and mm-hmm. we need to run it better, and we need to provide our key human services at a much more effective level than we have in the past. That said, what I am seeing in every truth and taxation hearing that I go to mm-hmm. and as I go around the valley is, gee, this same phrase I hear over and over and over again from people. I don't know whether it's the mosquito abatement. I don't know whether it's the school district. I don't know whether it's the county. I just know it all comes out of my same pocket, and I can't afford any more right now. Mm-hmm. When times are tough, we need to prioritize. We will get to do all the great things for the community in the arts, in the convention business, in the downtown development and trails and parks. We will continue to do all these great things. But when times are tough, we need to put first things first. And the first thing for the county, its core purpose is helping people who need mental health programs, jail, at-risk kids, seniors, drug treatment. That's what the county is about, and we need to put that a bit higher on our agenda than it's been in the past.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with Mark Crockett. He's the Republican nominee in the contest for Salt Lake County Mayor running against Democrat Ben McAdams. Mark, part of your opponent's strategy is clearly trying to gain support from other elected officials in the county, saying, here's who's standing behind the McAdams campaign, folks like Sandy Mayor Tom Dolan or the mayor of Taylorsville, Russ Wall. Is that part of your strategy as well, or do you opt to just talk to voters directly? What are you doing in comparison to his campaign?
I've never sought endorsements before. I think in some ways it tries to show that you're an insider, and I think we're ready for a new approach in government. That said, for all of Ben's talk about being across the aisle and all of that, and I'm sure he does do that as a legislator, you know, there's not one person who's elected as a Republican who's supporting him. And so maybe I should just put up some signs that say Democrats for Mark Crockett, because I have plenty of them supporting me too.
Oh, so you're saying these are nonpartisan offices. So while Russ Wall might identify as a Republican, he was not elected as such.
That's true. And his job for 4.5 years has been as the government relations guy for Salt Lake City. So if he doesn't get along well with the other mayors at this point, I'd be pretty surprised.
Does it sting, though, that some people who were supporting, for example, Mike Winder, your previous GOP opponent, have migrated to his campaign instead of yours?
Not really. I mean, I'm glad when people get involved when they take stands. I think that's a good thing. And if people like Ben's approach, which I think is a fairly traditional, let's go ahead and borrow, let's add programs, let's build a bunch of stuff, let's focus on downtown instead of the rest of the valley. If that's the way that they believe that the county should spend our countywide resources, then they should support him.
So, Mark, one of the things you've been highlighting in this campaign is your experience in the private sector and saving corporations money. How have you done that exactly?
I started off in a firm very similar to Mitt Romney's. I was at McKinsey. He was at Bain. McKinsey's the older, bigger version. We would come in, give a bunch of smart answers, and then wonder sometimes why they didn't get implemented. So some friends of mine and I, we left, turned it upside down, and said, you know what, maybe the reason that we our stuff wasn't being implemented before was because we had the wrong answer. The people who generally know best are on the front lines. They are the frontline managers. They are the people who provide the services every day. They are the customers, the people that we serve, all the stakeholders, if you will. When we've done this for government before, it's imagine if you get the drilling company, the wilderness protection groups, the wildlife groups, the water groups, all together in a room to talk about a particular policy, a particular function for government, and have them come up with the right ideas, quantify what the financial impact is, sign off on it, and then we hold everybody accountable to move forward together. That's how we do the work. We've done it for lots and lots of different entities and have saved people billions of dollars a year. If we do even a fraction as much with the county on a percentage basis, we will save $40 to $80 million, be able to avoid a tax increase, and be able to put some money on some really important priorities around human services and maybe even focus on a better way for us to create jobs in the county.
Do you see that cutting spending in the private sector versus cutting spending in the public sector, that they're two fundamentally different things or not?
No, not at all. I mean, the way most people think about it, maybe there are three ways people think about cutting spending. One is, let's just cut programs. That's not an option at the county. These are really important services that we as a community have decided we want and we need. So that's not what we need to be talking about at all, and I'm certainly not talking about it. Another one is what the county has been doing the last several years, which is to tighten belts and throw furniture out the window. It works for a little while, but holding employee pay down at the county, which is what Caroon is doing right now to band-aid the budget together, is completely unsustainable. So then you come to, well, then what do we do? If we can't just tighten the belt, we can't cut programs, what do you do? You have to actually redesign the way the work is done. How do you find 10, 15% savings? Well, we do a lot of things that follow, that have paper following through all over the place through the county, as opposed to you just do some clicks at home. There will be literally in the 300 programs that we have, there will be literally thousands of different changes that we make. They'll be small. They'll be large. We'll get community input on all of it. There's been a plan on my website for months now, month by month, exactly what we do through next year. I mean, it's a high level. It's on a website, right? It's a high level. But month by month, what we do as a community to come together and redesign these programs in a way that everybody buys in on, and that will save a lot while improving services and improving morale at the county.
One thing you mentioned, Mark, specifically on your website is what you call insufficient understanding of the costs. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are so many examples, but on the operating side, if you go in right now and look at the budget, there are three different versions of what the county spends overall: $975, $955, $820 million. You try to figure out what the cost of a department is. It's almost impossible. You certainly can't figure out what we spend on Meals on Wheels or what we spend on nutritionists within Meals on Wheels. Until you get down to that level of information, here's what we spend on nutrition, here's what we spend on making meals, here's what we spend on delivering meals, here's how much we spend in time checking up on people and asking them which questions when we're there. Unless you know what those things are costing and what the value is in the community that is seen around that level of detail, you know, it's like asking, hey, how can you improve America? How can you make world peace more secure? How can you make the county better? How can you make the county better at that level is an unanswerable question. How can we make meals more nutritious and at a better cost when we deliver them to these people's homes? Now, that's a question that we can get our heads around.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Mark Crockett. He is the GOP nominee for Salt Lake County Mayor. He and opponent Ben McAdams will appear at a Meet the County Mayor Candidates Night coming up September 26th at 6 p.m. at the County Government Center. Tune in for that live broadcast here on KCBW and go to kcbw.org if you would like more information on that. Your website also talks, Mark, about holding people more accountable when it comes to budgeting. How does that need to improve? From your time on the county council, did you see that people weren't being held accountable?
I don't think that they really were, but then the system wasn't set up to hold them accountable or even ask them to. It's what I think we're used to hearing about in private sector and in public sector is a county council goes into a room, they're given what information is given to them by the mayor, and they say, well, I'll make this tweak, I'll make that tweak, and then here's the budget, and y'all go follow it. You know, never mind that we didn't really systematically ask people what was needed, what was broken, what could be better, what investment was required, where savings could be achieved, how we could make programs more effective. We have not systematically asked that question in county government ever. And unless you're going to include people on the front lines, it's very hard to hold them accountable for a choice they didn't make and they weren't involved in, especially in government.
Mark, we talked with you recently about kind of dueling op-eds that you and the incumbent mayor, Peter Caroon, wrote in the Salt Lake Tribune about the county's debt load. There was a piece on UtahPolicy.com that said even Republicans and county government were frustrated with you, claiming that they felt that you were overstating the amount of the county's debt and kind of make it look like they were not doing their job. What's your response to that when you state the county's debt load, for example, as $2 billion on your website? What does that mean? And have you gone a little bit too far?
I don't say that we have a county debt load of $2 billion. I've never said that. Okay. People have, you know, maybe I could have been more clear, though I've tried to be very clear about what I've been saying. What I have been saying is that through the county, over the last 8 years, we have facilitated borrowing of almost $2 billion. And it goes back to the point that I was making earlier.
Okay.
You know, the little old ladies who were going to the truth and taxation hearings, you know, they freely admit when they're standing there, I understand that you need to do this for the police or for the roads. And I don't know whether you raised my taxes before or, in other words, at the county and the borrowing. I don't know whether the county borrowed it or UTA borrowed it or the mosquito abatement group borrowed it. I don't know whether it borrowed it, but all I know is I can't afford more right now. And in times that are tough, we need to put first things first. My plea is let's take just a little bit of a timeout on building more buildings and instead focus what on the county's core mission, which is building people who need our help. If you think about the state as Medicaid, education, big transportation projects, scary people who belong in prison, and cities are about fire, police, and planning and zoning, the county has two parts. One is regional services, convention centers, golf courses, rec centers, things like that. They are things that are wonderful and great, and we have invested a lot of money in those over the last years. Times were good, and that was maybe a great thing to do. On the flip side, the only thing that the county is actually statutorily required to do on a countywide basis are to help people who we're worried about but we haven't given up on. Mm-hmm. Jail, mental health, drug treatment. Those programs are $350 million. They have not gotten the attention they need. They're no more effective than other places around the country, even though we have these most amazing people here in this valley. Why is it that our county programs are no more effective than they are anywhere else in the country? Can we just take a little bit of time out on borrowing, which also competes with education dollars, which all comes out of the same pocket, right? Anybody who's out borrowing money right now is making it harder for anybody else to spend. And I think we need to focus a bit more on people right now.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with Mark Crockett, who's the Republican nominee for Salt Lake County Mayor. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Politics Up Close here on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson, speaking this hour with Mark Crockett, who is the Republican nominee for Salt Lake County Mayor. He'll join opponent Ben McAdams September 26th for a Meet the County Mayor's Candidate Night hosted by KCPW and Salt Lake County's Council on Diversity Affairs. For more information on that event and live broadcast, go to our website at kcpw.org. Mark, we were talking before the break about county spending and your point that we need to invest more in people and not in buildings. On that very same note, the issue, there are some very hot topics right now being debated in the council. One was the Broadway-style theater, the Utah Performing Arts Center. Two Republicans on the council recently joined the Democrats in approving about $28 million in funding for that project in conjunction with Salt Lake City. What's your take? Should they have rejected it?
I fear that maybe they should. To lay my cards on the table about this one, I went to college on a cello performance scholarship. My family has probably been to a dozen Broadway shows over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I would love for this to be the right thing for the community, but when I'm having a hard time believing that it isn't going to have a significant impact on the Capitol Theater. Or on the Pioneer Theater, or on a Bravenel Hall. You know, Hale Theater is probably going to be fine because it's a different audience. It's right. A different price point. But I'm worried that it's actually going to really create a big drain. In fact, the deal that was agreed on, and I think the county council did a nice job of actually limiting the role that the county is going to play to, you know, maybe a proportionate level. But that deal already contemplates losses and subsidies from the new theater to the Capitol Theater because we know that there's going to be a financial impact on the Capitol Theater. Mm-hmm. So I'm just concerned about what it does to arts downtown. 30 years from now, I'm pretty sure we want that theater. For the next 10 or 15, I'm still not convinced.
If you are elected mayor, would you attempt to veto that funding in some way, or would you say that this was the council's decision and perhaps that should stand?
I think that the council, having moved forward, we have a direction. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it is the mayor's job to do homework. I know that Salt Lake City and, in fact, Ben McAdams was one of the main drivers behind this, I think on behalf of Mayor Becker over the last few years. I know they've done their homework, but the county needs to do its homework. Mm-hmm. And I need to make sure that we do ours. I'll just cite an example about that. But, if we remember the soccer stadium stuff several years ago,
sure.
My argument then was that it needed to be proportional. And it was, I thought, too much that the county was investing. $35 million on top of another 40 or 50 that other people were spending. But what was really behind my fears about that Sark team were that the financial statements were awful. They weren't well organized. They showed that the team would lose tons of money. And in fact, it's while the team is great and I love taking my friends there and my family there, it really helps if on the front end we do our homework first. Ask all the right questions and all agree on assumptions that are believable before we take the big jump. So I think we have a direction at this point, but there's probably more homework that the county mayor needs to do.
On that same note, there's another big decision looming that probably won't be made before this election. So if you win, you would be in office for it. The Convention Center Hotel topic, it's been a point of debate for many years now. Supporters say, if we reject this idea of the county partnering with the private sector to build a convention center hotel, you might save some money now, but it would be a penny wise and a pound foolish because we need this convention center business in Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County. Where do you come down on that? Is there any role the county should play in building such a hotel to accompany the Salt Palace, or does it need to be 100% private sector?
The proposals that I am being told about now, and I think that there are a few of them that are still circulating, so it's hard to have a definitive position yet. Mm-hmm. I'm doing my best to listen to all the different angles and reasons and the math at the moment. But the main one that I'm hearing about at the moment does not contemplate public funding for the hotel itself, but maybe for a bunch of infrastructure and maybe some updates at the convention center itself that facilitate that. I don't know whether that's the best use of our money. I don't know whether that is something that is really necessary or what it does to the other hotels. Right now, one of my bellwethers that I'm watching on that is the other private sector hotels downtown seem to have a lot of heartburn about this. I've had some of them come up to me and say, you know, you cannot let this happen. And if hotels that are going to benefit from a convention center being full – are that concerned about the way that this proposal is coming together, that signals to me that we may not quite have the right answer yet.
Mark, another thing you talk about on your website is good old boys politics. You say the county currently suffers from that. How does it suffer from that, and what do you think you could do as mayor to turn that around?
Well, this may sound a little strange, Jeff, but I actually think that the biggest divide in politics is probably not between conservatives and liberals or Republicans and Democrats, but is between the people who are working for themselves and the people who are working for all the rest of us. It's amazing how many times at the county, or we see it in national government, certainly, but it's mirrored here at home, too. I owe this favor. Oh, well, you know, my friend. Mm-hmm. Or, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine.
Right.
Instead of just, let's find out what the right answer is and let's solve the problems. Let's focus on how we get the best services to people at the lowest possible price and do our most important things first. So, yeah, I hear my opponent, Ben, going around talking about how he's a nice guy, easy to get along with. But, you know, the people he's getting along with are politicians, professional government relations people like himself. It's great that he's good at that. That is his job. I'm glad. But there's one group of people that's systematically missing from all those conversations. All the taxpayers. They aren't in those rooms. And somebody needs to be looking out for them. As the executive of the county, as opposed to the government relations person for the county, the mayor's job is to do homework, to run things well, make sure that the general interest is served first.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Mark Crockett, the Republican nominee for Salt Lake County Mayor. Mark, changing gears a bit, one issue that is particularly relevant this election to the district you used to represent on the county's east side is the incorporation of Mill Creek Township. Voters there will decide on the November ballot whether to incorporate or not, an issue that's proven to be very divisive for people who are following it closely. What's your position on this, and perhaps as county mayor, what's your position on the role the county should play or perhaps not play when communities make this decision to incorporate?
Jeff, this is a question that's near and dear to my heart. When I was on the county council before Mill Creek was the area I felt most responsible for because I was the only elected person for that area. And the first thing that I would say about it is if any of you who are listening live in Mill Creek, please don't let this be divisive. We have tried so hard, your community leaders have tried so hard over the last several years of building Mill Creek into a community. It's a wonderful place. Don't let just a form of government drive how you feel about your neighbors. That said, as a county mayor, a candidate for county mayor, I have two things that I'm saying to both the people who oppose and the people who are for the incorporation. Interestingly enough, the leaders of both camps seem to be supporting me. The two things that I'm saying are, one, as county mayor, my job is to make sure that it's irresistible to leave. by improving services, reducing costs, and increasing the voice that people have in their own community. On the other hand, if I live two blocks away from where I do in Holiday and I hadn't already been annexed into Holiday, I would be leading the drive to incorporate. Being in unincorporated area is just not as good a deal. You can see it when you drive down the road that when the sidewalk starts to crumble, you know you've gone into unincorporated county. There has been a, just, you know, never mind all the complicated math. We can see with our own very eyes that money has systematically funneled out of unincorporated areas into cities, that there is no voice that is actually yours. There's not one person who is supposedly representing Mill Creek who is actually elected from Mill Creek right now. And then here's maybe, and even if I may go on, there is something that I worry about even more. At some point, you know, we kind of decided 60 years ago that cities were it. I don't know that that was the right choice. Metro government might have been better. But we have 16 cities now, so right. I don't think we're going back. And so whether Mill Creek incorporates now, is annexed in four pieces in a few years, or something else happens 10 years from now, we can see where the game is going. The county has resisted this change for so long that it now has no plan in place. If Mill Creek goes this fall, what happens to Magna, Kearns, Copperton, White City, Granite Township? The financial impact could be very large. The county needs to pull its head out of the sand and start making a plan, a transition plan, for what happens to all of these, particularly West Side communities, who are going to need some help for 10 or 15 years if Mill Creek were to suddenly disappear.
So if you are elected as mayor then, and let's say Mill Creek does not end up incorporating, would you turn the situation around? Like you were saying, you know, the crumbling sidewalks and that sort of thing. Would you make a conscious effort to say no more neglecting the these areas and this infrastructure?
Absolutely. I would do my very best. But these are, in many ways, longer-term issues, right? How do you get the money for – I mean, we could do another bond, and maybe that's the right thing to do, an infrastructure bond to get things back up to snuff. But, you know, we already have talked about bonding, and that's a difficult thing for people right now to borrow more. Giving them more voice in their community, we would have to have state law changed to get them an actual representative from this for themselves to go speak at the Council of Governments and to interact with other mayors and go speak for themselves at the legislature. These would be huge structural changes. And until those structural changes occur, I'll do everything I can as a mayor, but I probably will still be somewhat limited.
Mark, in our final few minutes here, let's get into the campaign and what lies ahead. Well, first of all, do you expect, as many people have said, this could be the single most competitive race on the ballot in Salt Lake County or in the entire state of Utah?
I expect that it probably will be competitive. It looks like we're a bit ahead right now, and I hope that will hold. But yeah, this is an important race. If people can just think, $820 million. Services that help people's families decide whether their mom can stay in their home longer, or how you're going to get the problematic stepson back into the right group of friends. You know, these are the kinds of things that the county wrestles with. It should be a competitive race. It should be one that we care a lot about. We will be, but if you've heard for the listeners. If you've heard anything in what I've said today so far that you like, please go to my website, www.markcrockett.com. You can see videos of me talking about things, explaining what the county does, a plan for what we do this coming year, an opportunity for, of course, you to donate or get involved. We'd love to have you. But we're just trying to right now mostly make sure people understand what the county does, why it's important, and the role of the county mayor as an executive leading a very large and complicated organization.
Do you expect the, you know, pretty civil tone of the campaign to stick? There's been, you know, some criticism back and forth, but do you think at some point it's going to be more of, you know, attack mode? Let's go after my opponent. Let's run the negative ads and go after his record.
I'm only going to talk about issues. I have nothing negative to say about Ben. I'm, at this point, somewhat jaded about all of the random rumors and stuff that has been thrown at me over the years. And you just kind of know that that's what's going to come and that people make stuff up because they want their side to win. What I'm going to be doing is trying to talk about just, hey, this is what the county does. This is what the job entails. Here's how we move forward. Here's how we get the community together in a real way to solve problems. And, if that's the message that wins, then so be it.
Are you saying your opponent has been generating random rumors about you or other people?
It started, I think, about 4 months after I was elected to the county council years ago. And, we don't need to go into that. But, anybody who's run for politics, they know that stuff gets made up and thrown around.
Finally, let's talk about the fundraising aspect, Mark. Do you think, whoever has the bigger bank account will be a significant factor in this race? And, can you raise the money you need to win?
I think we can raise the money that we need to win. We probably won't raise as much money as my opponent is doing. We don't need to, probably, given where we stand in the race. If we can spend, if we could spend a third as much, we think we'll win. We have a good strategy. We have the right issues. So far, Ben hasn't actually talked about anything particular of substance. So as we go into debates, as we go in, for the example, the one here with you on the 26th, mm-hmm. if we talk issue by issue by issue, I think we have the right issues, and we will definitely have enough money to get enough of the message out to support that. So we feel pretty good.
We've been speaking with Mark Crockett. He is the Republican nominee for Salt Lake County Mayor. He and Ben McAdams will appear September 26th at 6 p.m. at the County Government Center. It's a Meet the County Mayor Candidates Night with the hosted by KCPW and Salt Lake County's Council on Diversity Affairs. Go to kcpw.org for the details of that event. Mark, we look forward to seeing you there, and thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thanks so much.
This is Politics Up Close. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Politics Up Close on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. An op-ed in the New York Times this week that coincided with the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks has reignited the debate over just how much information the George W. Bush administration knew about a potential al-Qaeda attack on American soil in the months leading up to the tragedy. And its author has also published a new book that chronicles, quote, harrowing decisions, deceptions, and delusions that changed America and the world forever in the months after 9/11. Kurt Eichenwald is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. He joins me now on the phone. Kurt, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kurt, let me start off by asking about your op-ed. Before we get into some of the specifics, remind us about this August 2001 memo that you start off with that was released in 2004 by the Bush administration, and what exactly that said.
This is the fairly famous memo. It's a presidential daily brief that had the headline, Bin Laden Determined to Strike U.S. And that was released because the 9/11 Commission was pushing to find out what did President Bush know and when did he know it. And so the briefings he received would be fairly important. Well, that one was the only one that was released. And the administration said, truthfully, actually, that this was a historical document, that even though it said Bin Laden determined to strike U.S., that was more of a general comment, that, this is his goal. And so when you read it, you could say, okay, it's a historical document. Problem is that was a red herring, because what they did is they withheld all the other records. And, in fact, Condoleezza Rice testified, if we'd had information saying there was going to be an attack, we obviously would have acted on that.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was now able to gain access to the other presidential daily briefs, and what they showed is there were enormous numbers of very specific briefings of very specific information that an attack was coming. On May 1st of 2001, President Bush was told that there was an al-Qaeda cell in the United States that it was planning to strike. He was told over the coming weeks there were going to be mass casualties. He was told that Bin Laden was directly behind it. He was told that the planning and the timing was flexible. In July, he was told the attack would be sometime in the next couple of months. I mean, detail after detail after detail. Now, these were kept classified, and actually they still are classified. And it's there's no reason for them to be classified. There's no disclosure of sources. There's no disclosure of anything except for here is what the president was told 11 years ago, and in 2004, here's what he was told 3 years ago. And the only reason it wasn't released, it was an abuse, in my opinion, an abuse of the classification system. It was keeping things under wraps that were embarrassing, rather than keeping things under wraps for the security of the United States.
So, Kurt, as you describe it, the reason that these briefings weren't acted upon is that there was some kind of internal strife between the CIA and officials in the White House itself. Set that up for us. Talk about what did the CIA want versus the White House.
The CIA, the people there had been through several administrations. They had dealt with the threat of al-Qaeda terrorism before. They had had a major, major bump up in information about a possible threat in December of 99, which led to a high government alert, and the multiple terrorist attacks were stopped. That's why, you know, Americans don't remember what happened in 99-2000 because it was stopped. When they got to the Bush administration, suddenly in, you know, after 6 months of the administration, the threat intelligence is popping higher and higher and higher until it's worse than what they had in December of 1999. And what the CIA was looking for was, you know, act off of the precedent. Let's go on high government alert. But at the same time, you had the neoconservatives in the Pentagon, who had spent their entire time during the Clinton administration working with private organizations, you know, dedicated to bringing down Saddam of Iraq, who were saying no. Bin Laden is a puppet of Saddam Hussein. This is a false flag operation where Bin Laden is trying to make us think that there's an attack coming, but he's really doing it so we take our eyes off of Saddam Hussein. I mean, information that, you know, an allegation that had absolutely no basis in reality, had no evidence to support it, and was just an assertion on the part of people who thought that Iraq was the most important thing in the world. And so by late June of 2001, you have the CIA, rather than saying, okay, let's delve into, you know, this attack that's coming in greater specificity, is spending their time going, no, really, this is real. Bin Laden isn't fooling us. This is not, you know, this is not a distraction from Iraq. This is a real attack that's coming. And it was a wasted time. It was... you know, combating falsehoods with evidence. And, you know, the falsehoods won out too many times. And it was so bad that by July 9th of 2001, there was a meeting in the Counterterrorism Center, and this you'll find out in 500 Days, the book.
Uh-huh.
There was a meeting in the Counterterrorism Center where the officials there one of the officials suggested that they put in for a mass transfer. In other words, everyone get out of the counterterrorism center. And the words they used were, you know, we have something coming and it's going to be really, really bad. And when it happens, they're going to blame us. And the senior officer in that room said, yeah, but we can't get enough trained people in here fast enough. So there's nobody, the phrase used, there's nobody more qualified than us to ride this thing down. Now think of the level of fatalism there. They're not saying, gee, maybe something will happen. They're saying, it's going to happen. If we're here when it happens, it's going to wreck us. I don't want to be the one responsible, but being here is pointless. Because no matter what they say, what we say, they don't do anything. And so, you know, that's the nature of the reality of what was going on.
This is Politics Up Close. We're speaking with Kurt Eichenwald. He's author of the newly published 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, and he's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Kurt, I'm not sure how much detail you can go into, but can you give us a picture of what you had to do to get a hold of these documents that, as you say, have yet to be released, the ones that showed just how much information the CIA and the Bush administration had on al-Qaeda?
I've gotten very good over the years at getting people to cooperate with me and getting people to provide me with information and to talk to me about mm-hmm. things. And the reason I'm good at it is because they know that I never disclose anything. So in terms of what I would be able to tell you about how I did it and so on, I can't. And okay. because of that, sometime in the future, I'll be able to get some other documents.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, as you know, the reaction to your op-ed has been fierce from the right, with President Bush's former spokesman, Ari Fleischer, even referring to you as a truther, one of these conspiracy theorists who believes that the Bush administration not only let 9/11 happen, but actually caused it directly. Were you expecting this reaction, and is it indicative of the reaction you're getting across the spectrum, or is that pretty limited, do you think?
You do have people who are conservatives who were in the Bush White House. It's only a couple of them. That's what's so funny. In the Bush White House or otherwise conservative commentators who, you know, one of the worst things, one of the biggest disservices that was done to President Bush was these people's approach to bad news. Because they would get bad news, and rather than, you know, acknowledging it and giving a response, and there's always a response that could be done, and moving on, they instead attack the messenger. They did it to the former White House terrorism czar, Richard Clark, when he told the 9/11 Commission that within a day of the 9/11 attack, that Bush was asking him to dig up information on Iraq. They went after the fellow who came back and established that the claim that Saddam Hussein had developed or had purchased yellowcake uranium from Niger was false. But rather than saying, oh, okay, let's adapt our intelligence, they just went after him in a vicious way. And when they see my work that says here, I mean, basically what it says is, here is what the documents say, quote, and they react with attacking me and calling me names and doing everything they can to denigrate history. And, you know, unfortunately for them, I give out twice as well as I get. So they hit me, I hit back. And there have been more than a couple of confrontations where I point out, you know, you're making, what, I'll just say, what is that? Is it that I've written that's wrong? Mm-hmm. And they won't answer because they don't have anything. And again, I think they're doing a huge disservice to President Bush. Nobody caused this information to get more public than the people on the conservative side who were fighting it, you know, who were trying to make it go away. And as a result, it became this huge controversy, and controversies attract attention. Other than those people, I've had a lot of people who were directly involved in these events call me up and thank me. I had one guy who sent me an email who was, you know, in the room when these briefings took place. Uh-huh. And his statement was, bless you. You know, most people do not have concerns about truth or reality. It's only those people who want to control reality that have trouble with it, because ultimately you can't control it.
We're speaking with Kurt Eichenwald. He is the author of the newly published 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. And Kurt, let's get specifically into your book. First, what are the 500 days specifically that you chronicle in your book? Is it the 500 days right after 9/11?
Yeah, I mean, my original idea was I was going to write a book about counterterrorism in the 8 years of the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And after a couple of years of reporting, I came to realize that the real story was in the first 500 days, that was when all the decisions were made. That was when we were put on a course that we're still on to this day, and that everything after that was merely, you know, reaction. Mm-hmm. And so my decision was that, you know, to really understand what happened, we really had to understand those 500 days. And so the book starts on 9/11. Well, there's a prologue that gives you information about before 9/11. But the main part of the book starts on 9/11, and it ends the night of the first bombing of Iraq, because that was the final big decision. Mm-hmm. And so what you get from 500 days is the chance and opportunity to be able to understand how we ended up where we were, what the decisions were, and why they were made.
And so let's go through some of the specific points in your book. One of them is that the administration was using what they thought or what they said was an Al-Qaeda training manual that justified their actions, but it turned out not to be anything of the sort. What was this manual exactly, and what did the Bush administration do with it to justify the Iraq war or its counterterrorism policies in general?
The Al-Qaeda training manual was not intentionally misrepresented, but it was used for a lot of purposes. If you go to the Pentagon website for Guantanamo, you'll see it mentioned a lot. You'll see, I think it still might be there for downloading. Here is what we're up against. These people have been trained in all of these issues, and that's what we have to combat. The manual was submitted as evidence in criminal cases against terrorists. It was used in the formation of interrogation policy. It was used in the establishment of detention policy. Mm-hmm. And in the end, what I discovered was that it was not an Al-Qaeda training manual. And that started to come about when I was meeting overseas with somebody who was in Middle Eastern intelligence, and I brought up this manual. And, you know, he smirked. He didn't laugh, but was close to laughing. And he said, "Have you ever read it?" And I had to admit, no, I'd read about it, and I knew what everybody said it said. And he said, "Read it." And I said, "Why?" He said, "The idea that it's an Al-Qaeda training manual is ridiculous." Huh. And so I sat down and I read it, and it clearly wasn't. The document is something that was created in 1992 when Al-Qaeda was in absolute shambles, when bin Laden was off in Saudi Arabia. And what it was written by a ragtag Egyptian terrorist group of bumblers, very small. And their entire goal had nothing to do with the United States. Their goal was to overthrow the government of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. That runs totally counter to what the goals of Al-Qaeda are. And so when you're taking something written by somebody else about a different circumstance with different goals and applying it as intelligence to the development of your own policy, you end up with a lot of problems. One of the big things, and probably people have heard this a lot, was they said, look, they've been trained to come out and lie about being tortured. That's here, and they're told when they go to court they should start yelling out that they've been tortured and how they've been tortured, and they're being taught to lie. Well, that's completely false, because what they were talking about is when you are arrested by Egyptian security forces. They don't use those words, but that's, once you understand what the manual is, that's what they're talking about. If you are suspected of terrorism and you were arrested in Egypt at that time, you would be tortured. It's like if you were stopped going 160 miles an hour in a school zone, you will get a ticket or be arrested. And so what they were saying as the advice was, when you get to court, start shouting out how you've been tortured, because then maybe the judge will protect you. That's it. You know, and that became a basis of, you know, when they say they're tortured, they've been trained to say they're lying. You know, they've been trained to lie.
Another point in your book, Kurt, is that administration officials were keeping President Bush himself in the dark about a variety of things like their interrogation tactics and waterboarding. Are there any specific officials that you name in the book specifically? Are we talking about Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney himself even? Who are we referring to here?
Well, there was an example of this. There was a meeting in the White House in the Situation Room related to, you know, what they called enhanced interrogation techniques, what others call torture. And what I would say is, if somebody wants to call them enhanced interrogation techniques, let me perform them on you. And I think you'll use a different name when we're done. But they were having the meeting where they were establishing this, and they were walking through how waterboarding would work. And the White House counsel, Alberto Gonzalez, went up from the Situation Room to the Oval Office to meet with the president for a minute, and Bush said, you know, well, what's going on down there? And his response was, well, Mr. President, for your protection, I think you don't need to know what's going on here. You know, that was an example. Now, ultimately, Bush knew about the waterboarding and the rest. But at the time, as the policy was being formulated, he was kept in the dark. A bigger example would be on things leading up to the Iraq War. The British had an individual working in our military who was actually serving as a conduit from the British to us, but also was working on some levels as a spy for the British, you know, about what's going on in the United States. Huh. And their information coming back was that Donald Rumsfeld had a lot of details regarding Iraq that he was not bringing to the president. And there was great concern in the British government that Bush didn't know what was going on. And there were meetings that are depicted in 500 Days where they're saying, you know, only people who know, you know, the only person who knows what's going on is Rumsfeld. And Bush and his national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, don't know. And so that kind of secrecy... I mean, they really thought Rumsfeld was incompetent. When you're reading the British, you know, things in the book where the British are talking about Rumsfeld, they're not any compliments coming out. And so, but those are two examples.
And so, Kurt, is the point of the book that these mistakes made in the lead up to the Iraq War by the Bush administration, have they carried over into the Obama administration and the tactics that they use to combat terrorism as well? Is that kind of the big picture here?
Well, the point of the book is really, here is the history. You know, do with it what you will. In terms of what I consider the import, the meaning, yeah, these are things that have carried over to today. You have had, you know, terrorism policy was formulated by the Bush administration, and that policy has not been dramatically changed. You know, warrantless wiretapping is still going on. Guantanamo is still open. Military commissions to try terrorists are still, you know, the primary means. And, you know, you have to recognize, if this is going to be the basis of how the American government works going forward, it's very helpful to know what went into how these decisions were made. And that's really what 500 Days is all about. That's what makes the book important, I think.
We have been speaking with Kurt Eichenwald. He's the author of the newly published 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. You can read a recent op-ed by him in the New York Times about information the Bush administration knew about al-Qaeda in the months before the September 11th tragic attacks of 2001. Mr. Eichenwald, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on Politics Up Close.
Thanks for having me.